In this, our last class in the series about meditation, we're going to take everything that we've learned about creating a divine space made up of the six constant mitzvot and apply them to the mitzvah of shaking lulav on Sukkot. Now, the connection should be obvious. Connection should be obvious because this is the one mitzvah that we have that we physically shake to six directions, and we have the one of the intentions is that God is all around me. That's simply one of the kavanot of shaking lulav, is God is all around me. And so therefore shaking to the directions is just it's a physical help to realizing that. But here we have the obvious connection that shaking lulav is also making a divine space around ourselves. And the way we can see that is that there are two motions to shaking the lulav. Every time we shake the lulav, we shake. Go backwards. First, we hold it to our heart. Then we shake to a direction. We go out and shake, and then we draw it in. We go out and we go in. Three times to each direction, which gives us the very significant number of 18. Hi. So what we're doing, independent of this whole meditation, is we're told that when we shake lulav, we are taking our life force and trying to manifest it in the world. And we're taking God's life force and trying to bring it within us. That's the energy that is happening. And when it's all together, all 18, so we have created this force field of life force. So we see how beautifully that fits in to our six cube meditation. Because we haven't used those terms yet, but the same thing is happening. So just a little, background to shaking lulav is that in one of the classes we learned that we can envision the holidays as also God's name. Just like we learned that the holiday of Yom Kippur can be seen as a manifestation of the four letters of God's name. So we learned that all of the holidays of this month can be seen. Where the first day of Rosh Hashanah, this is just review, the first day of Rosh Hashanah is what's called the point of the Yud, the kotz of the Yud. And then the second day of Rosh Hashanah is the Yud. Yom Kippur becomes the Hay, God's name. Sukkot becomes the Vav. And Simchas Torah becomes the Lower Hay. Each one of these is very beautiful and deep and profound connections to it. For our purposes, though, we see that the letter Vav is connected to the holiday of Sukkot. So this is obvious because we're shaking lulav every day to six directions. That's the connection with Sukkot. But the idea of starting with the kotz of the Yud with Rosh Hashanah means that the first day of Rosh Hashanah is, as it were, way up there. The energy we're trying to connect is like way up there. Second day of Rosh Hashanah comes down a little bit. By Yom Kippur, we draw it down even more. By Sukkot, it comes down even more. And then by Simchas Torah, it's at the lower hay. And what are we doing? We're dancing. It's all the way down to the feet. It's the image of going from the head. What is Rosh Hashanah called again? Rosh. The head of the year. And we end up dancing on Simchas Torah with our feet. So Sukkot becomes the critical transitional holiday. Why? Because Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are both very ethereal, especially Yom Kippur. We're not eating, we're not drinking, we're in shul all day, we dress like angels, we're like barely connected to this world. But what's the transition? Sukkot, we pick up the arba, meaning the four species, a lulav, etrog, arva, and hadas, a palm branch, a citron fruit, a myrtle branch, myrtle branches, and willow. And these, by the way, relate to the four letters of God's name also. The four species relate to the four letters of God's name. But what do? We take it in our hands and we start shaking out. So this represents something very, very important. Is we're taking from the more spiritual, ethereal, hard to grasp energy of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and now we're trying to put it into the world. We take it in our hands with the four meanings, because the correspondence that we made with Yom Kippur, that the four letters of God's name represent four different levels of Yom Kippur, but again, they were all soul-like, divine-like. Whereas by Sukkot, the four become four tangible species that we take in our hands, and we're shaking out, and we're drawing in. And this is a very, very important understanding of Sukkot. That when we shake lulav, what we're doing in essence is we're extending the prayers of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we're trying to put them in the world. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we're praying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to change that way, I'm going to start being this way. But it's like we barely have a chance to, because it's all very happening so quickly. But then Sukkot, we build a physical sukkah. Now remember, the sukkah is also a cube. The physical sukkah that we dwell in is a cube. It is the physical representation of the divine space that we've been building through our meditation. You see how that works? It makes it very tangible. Very tangible. And that's why the sukkah itself is a very meditative place. Very meditative. Especially if you can be even for a few minutes alone in a sukkah. You look at the six planes of the cube of the physical sukkah, and as you feel surrounded by God's divine energy, and then you can transfer that to building a meditative divine space. So therefore, by all of the Rebbe's, they would shake lulav in their sukkah. That's where they would shake lulav. Because it's, in a sense, it's the most appropriate place to shake the lulav when you're in the sukkah. And so therefore, sukkah becomes the transition, in a sense, from spiritual to physical, of trying to draw this energy. So this was, in a sense, all to explain this idea of life force. When we get to Sukkot, we're shaking out in order to take all of this soul power that hopefully we've built up in the holidays. Now what we're trying to do is like, okay, now I'm really going to do it. I'm going to take it in hand and I'm going to put it into the world. And then also we're aware that God's energy is everywhere, so we want to draw this energy into us. So we're creating this divine space, but now in a very physical way, through the four physical species, and shaking to the six directions, and if possible, in a sukkah, which is a divine space. In a sense, it's like the energy of the Shekhinah in the temple. Okay, having said all of that, so now let's plug our divine space of the meditation into the actual shaking here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a couple of examples of how we can use this in what I call from the practical to the mystical. So what's interesting here is this order is not the order that we shake the lulav. So it becomes a little complicated. So there are two basic ways. There's the Kabbalistic way that follows the Arizal, and there's the Ashkenazic way. So I'm going to give over the way of the Arizal, the order that he shook in. But everyone should do according to whatever their minhag is. But the way he did it, if you notice here, the spherot are not in their natural logical order here. The Arizal, when he would shake lulav, he would shake according to the natural order of the spherot. So therefore, for those of you who want to make either a physical note or a mental note, the first direction is chesed, to the right. And then, remember, we're facing east. Next is Gevura, to the left or north. The third is Tiferet, which is in front of us. Then is Netzach, above. Then Hod, below. And then Yesod, behind. And each time that we draw it into our heart, that is Malchut. Remember, the seventh level of prayer and Malchut and David is us in the middle of the cube. Okay, so did everyone follow that? So in other words, just the Arizal just followed the order of the Sefirot. So I will follow that order and I'll give a few examples. And at the end, I would really like to for everyone to be able to meditate on this, even in short, it's kind of like a practice run for shaking the lulav. Okay, so therefore, since the shaking lulav becomes an extension of the prayers of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so I'm thinking very, very much about everything that happened in Elul and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur that are, in a sense, fueling my prayers when I'm shaking lulav. So when I turn to the right, and by many of the Hasidim, you'll see two different ways. Some people stand towards the east and just put their arms towards the direction. Whereas by many Hasidim, they actually turn towards that direction. personally, that is what I do. So when you turn to the south, you're turning towards chesed. The inner sense of chesed is love. And the person who is related to this characteristic is Avram. Now you'll notice that the seven souls here, these are the Yushpizim. These are the very souls that we're inviting every day and every night into our sukkahs. So that takes an even greater significance, because every day we're inviting all seven of these. But each one has their day. The first day is Avraham, second day is Yitzhak, etc. So when I turn to the right, so the first thing I try to connect to is the love of God. So I'm shaking in the sense to arouse the love of God. I want to experience that in my soul. And it goes without saying that this is shaking lulav does not have to be rushed through. You can't really do this properly by rushing through it. So therefore, the more time that you have, the better it is. So how long does it take to arouse love of God? It could take a second, it could take a long time. But the idea is to arouse in our hearts a love of God. Connected with that is the aspect of chesed. So since this whole period is a time of tikkun, so then I might concentrate on chesed in my neshama. And I might ask myself, am I manifesting enough love in my relationships? Is there a certain person I could be more loving with? Am I giving enough? Do I give enough time to my community? Do I give enough charity? Do I give enough time to learn? Do I give enough time to do favors for other people? And obviously, it's infinite. Do I give enough time to myself? Or am I giving to others only time that's no good for myself? Absolutely. Do I love myself? Or am I down on myself all the time? Especially this time of year, coming through after Yom Kippur, when we're going like this all day long, it's not hard to get down on ourselves. So, do I love myself enough? Now, obviously, each person, according to what they've been dwelling on through this time of Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, it can bring up lots of feelings. But here, because we're shaking out, the emphasis is, how do I manifest this? I want to be a more giving person. How can I do this? How should I do this? So that's what it's actually, it's very mystical, but it's very practical. It becomes a very, very potent and powerful means of affecting change. And then I'll connect to Avraham. And it could be also with the matriarch also that's connected with these souls. So Sarah. So many times I envision different incidences in Avram's life, and it's like I would like to be like that also, right? And then I draw Avram into my heart. This Avram is an archetypal energy. It's not just the stories we read in black and white. It's an archetypal energy. And so I want to draw love into my heart. I want to draw love into my life. I want to draw Avram into my life. I want to draw the strength that Avram exhibited into my life. And so you can see from that, and also the idea of self, each one of these directions. It says, if you want to become wise, turn to the south. If you want to become wealthy, turn to the north. Now, each direction has all kinds of associations with it. And the south, and you know why those two particular ones? Is because in the temple, the menorah was on the south, and the 12 loaves of bread were on the north. So the light of the menorah represents the light of intellect.
Chochmah.
And the showbread represents livelihood. So therefore, the sages said, if you want to be wise, turn towards the south. Want to be rich, turn towards the north. So those also have associations here. So since you're turning towards the south, it's also a time to plug into wisdom, divine wisdom. God, I want to know your Torah. Or the verse, Gali Nai, the Abita Niflaot Natortecha. God, open my eyes that I should see wonders in your Torah. But obviously it's totally individual, because everyone has their own way of loving God. Everyone has their own challenges in giving and loving. So everyone's prayer is going to be different. And it could be something that's very, very present in your life. Or it could be more, let's say, global. But if you're, let's say you're having a problem with a relationship, and you really want to be close to this person, but it's just not happening. So it's a very, you're saying, wow, you're shaking. Because the shaking is like this active. It's like, I want it to happen. Right? I want it to happen. I want to make it happen. And the drawing in is, it's like all of the mitzvah. The physical action affects our mental, psychological, spiritual, emotional state. So drawing in really just helps us. You know, it's like when a woman lights candles on Shabbos and she's like taking the light, right? Taking the light in. So we could say, just do it mentally. But there's something about, right, that motion that helps. It helps. So that's why I'm saying that this meditation, which we can and should do mentally all the time, probably the most auspicious manifestation is when we're shaking lula. That's why it becomes so potent. So potent, because the shaking of the lula becomes like the physical extension of everything that we've learned in a mental state. And because ultimately, remember what we learned from the beginning, that the goal of meditation is to ultimately bring it back down and have it then manifest in the world. That we should not get hung up in the experience of the meditation and think that that's the end, that's the means and the ends. In other words, the meditation is a means to experience inner peace, godliness, self. And that's also the end. We said that the meditation is always just a means. Whatever we accomplish in the meditation, whatever insight we've garnished, we have to then take it and put it into the world. So the shaking of the lulav, as we said, in relationship to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, becomes symbolic of not letting the prayers of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur remain, as it were, like way up there or way deep in the heart. They need to come into the world. And so the physical sukkah and the physical shaking of the sukkah become the means to make it real to us. The Baal Shem Tov, I love this Torah because it puts it all together. As you might know, on the last day of Simchat Torah, Shemini Atzeret, we make the transition between asking for due and asking acknowledging that God makes the wind to blow and the rain to fall. And we do that on Simchat Torah. And this has tremendous significance. In fact, the theme of water runs through all of Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Hoshana Rabbah, and Simchat Torah. And I have this idea, and I have actually all of the notes as well, that I'm hoping that in the spring, God willing, I'm putting out a book called The Mystical Nature of Light. But I don't know how popular it's going to be, because it's not like the most popular subject. No, not everyone is going to be drawn to reading about the mystical nature of light. But if it's popular, so the next one is going to be The Mystical Nature of Water. But the Baal Shem Tov on the last day, I heard this from Rav Ginsburg. So he would say like this, and when he would say the words, he would do a hand motion. He would say, "Mashiv ruach u'morid hageshem." So on the simple way, we can understand that when he took his hand and like, it was like sending something away, like wind. He makes the wind to blow, and he makes the rain to fall. He would take his hand and, as it were, draw from above to below. But he explained it differently. He said like this. He said, "Mashiv haruach." We have to understand that the word for wind is the same word for spirit or spirituality. So ruach is wind, and spirituality is ruchnius, ruchniut. And it just turns out that the word for rain, geshem, is the same word for physicality or material reality, is gashmiut. So listen what he would say. This is an awesome Torah. Awesome. He would go like this. He'd say, "Enough of this ruchnius. Enough of this spirituality." Meaning, from Elo, Slichot, and Rosh Hashanah, and then more Slichot, and Yom Kippur, and 7 days of Sukkot, and shaking lulav and simcha beit shoeva every night, and simchas Torah dancing all day long, he'd say, "Enough of this ruchnias. It's time to draw it all into gashmias." Right? Enough of this ruchnias. We've been davening for like it seems like forever. Enough davening. Let's do it. So the transition again is Sukkot. Sukkot, we're already doing it with the shaking of the lulav. But when we get to Simchas Torah, so now we're dancing. And that also represents the feet, putting it into reality. So that was one example. I'll do one more. And then let someone be brave and explain to us how we can do this, how we can take this and turn it into a potent mystical but psychological and emotional and intellectual and spiritual exercise. So we'll do the next one. The next one, we turn to the left or north, and this is connected to Gevura. So here I'm connecting to God's judgment, because Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, was the day of judgment. Judgment is sealed. And I'm going back over the judgment, and I'm meditating on, contemplating, in a sense, what is my own judgment for the year, and what is the judgment for the world. I'll never forget, this was, it was beyond awesome. I think maybe only Rav Shalom will really appreciate this, is when the Intifada, or the Oslo War, broke out in the year 2000. It began Erev Rosh Hashanah. So remember, we went into Rosh Hashanah, and there were disturbances. And we went into Russia, like, no one knew what was going to be. But no one envisioned what was about to hit us. No one, on Rosh Hashanah. We knew something was brewing, but it came out of Rosh Hashanah, and it was like, pow! And that whole week, where things were happening all over. And during that week was what's now known as the lynch in Ramallah, which just shocked people, because the images that were shown on TV and the papers were so shocking. And then things just started going wild. And I'll just never forget standing in my sukkah. And for those who know the Moshav, really on the next hill is an Arab village. And I'm standing in my sukkah, and I turn towards the north, and I'm like, Rabbonus Olam, like, what is going on here? What judgments are coming down? What is happening? And I'll never forget shaking the lulav and trying to, like, grasp what judgment had come down in Rosh Hashanah. It was like, I was like shaking, because it was so real. And so we see that the inner sense of Gevura is fear. And that fear, obviously, in serving God, we want fear in the sense of awe. But there's also fear, the fear of punishment. That is also a positive thing. It could be positive. It could have the fear of all kinds of things, and phobias is not a positive thing. But in the sense, if fear of punishment will stop a thief from stealing, so it's good. Right, it's a good start. And if we do certain things in our service of God because of fear of punishment, it's not the worst thing either. Obviously, we want to strive for so much higher, so much deeper. But I'll never forget just feeling fear. Fear was in the air. You could cut it with a knife. It was unbelievable. It's unbelievable. That whole year and a half, in a sense, we learned to get used to it, but it was like, you walk down the street and you could cut fear with a knife. That was reality. I'll just never forget, because it was so new. It was only like 10. It was like 2 weeks later. And so we're contemplating, like, God's judgments in the world this year. Also, even though we might not understand the full expression of the judgment is right before Rosh Hashanah, there was this incident with Syria. And the truth is, we really don't know where that will lead and what it's a practice run for. I won't say more, but it would be wise to contemplate the judgments that are coming down in the world, as it will affect pretty much everyone. So, yeah, please God, they'll be good. God willing. So this is Gevura, right? But then there's the inner Gevura. Do I let people walk over me all the time? Do I know when to say no to others? Do I know when to say no to myself? How come I have no discipline? How come I decide to do things and I don't follow through? Where is my sense of priority? Where is my sense of order? Why can't I follow through? Or sometimes I'm too Gevura. Why did I yell at this person, 3 weeks ago? Why do I get angry so easily? I'm just taking different scenarios that we all can think about, and we turn it into something very personal. And again, we're shaking out in order to manifest the good part of Gevura into the world, and we're drawing in also to bring the good in. But also, when we're shaking out, we're pushing away. In fact, one of the intentions of shaking lulav, we're told, on a simple level, is the rains are about to come, and rain can be very destructive. Actually, we just saw it in the news yesterday, this plane that crashed in Thailand with, I'm not sure how many in the end, 8 or 10 Israelis who died. It was because the rains were so hard. The pilot just couldn't see anything. He couldn't operate the plane. So one of the ideas is that we're pushing away. The rain is one is God's chesed, but it's called gevurot hageshamim. The power of rain has a lot of gevura in it. And so we're like praying to keep those kinds of rains away. But what that means is we're trying to keep all kinds of destructive energies away from us. And then there are people, let's say they drink too much, or they gamble too much, or whatever it is like, I need to be able to say no. I need to be able to stop this. And then we can think about Yitzchak. And we can think about Yitzchak and Akedat Yitzchak. And draw incredible strength from what Yitzchak must have gone through. And what it means to carry on a tradition. For as great as Avram was, it's beyond our contemplation. Where would we have been if Yitzhak wouldn't have carried it on and taught it to Yaakov? So each one of us is a link in the chain also. Each one of us has an aspect of Yitzhak in us. And so here we want to, again, manifest this archetype personage. And his strength, his gevura, is shown not only by the Akedah, where he's ready to give his life for God, but also when he redigs the wells of Avram. After Avram dies, it says the Philistine, the Philistines, stuffed up all of the wells. So water represents Torah. Ein Mayim Ela Torah, says in the Talmud. Anytime water is mentioned, it's a allusion to Torah itself. So what does it mean that they stuffed up all the wells of Avram? It means that everything that Avram had taught, in a sense, was in danger of being forgotten. It was stuffed up. He wouldn't have lasted. Yitzhak went and he redug all of the wells. And no matter how many times they came and they argued with him, he just went and he redug another well. So this is a tremendous koach that we're talking about within ourselves, to be able to dig wells. And as we said, turning to the north is, you want to be rich, turn to the north. So this is a time for us to contemplate in a very practical way, how am I going to draw sustenance to my life? Am I happy in my job? Is this what I want to be doing? This is a great time for people who have Jewish institutions, right? To like kind of she's shaking out, like you're shaking up the world, like wake up, look at this tremendous institution we have, and then you draw, right? You draw the money towards it, and not in a crass way, in a very, very practical and spiritual way. We all have to live, right? We all have to pay the rent. We all have to eat. And some people have a real challenge doing this. So this is the opportunity to do this. So I hope everyone is following how powerful this can be. Because what we're doing is we're taking the living in divine space, and we are really making it very, very practical. Now, obviously, we can do this without lulav and etrog, without a sukkah, and not a sukkah's time. But the point is, until now, we've been dwelling on this meditation in a very inner, private, mental way. And this just shows us how we can actually now, through the means of how we attach it to sukkahs, we can take that same thing now, do it any time of the year. Do it any time of the year. And any one of these aspects can turn into an entire meditation in of itself. We could be dwelling on the love of God and just go with it. Allow our neshama, right, to run with it. To go with it. Okay, does anyone want to take a stab at one of these directions or mitzvot or people? You don't have to do the whole thing. If you can, that would be good. But if not, just pick one of these and explain to us, you're not revealing anything about a person, but how a person can use this in order to affect real change. Don't think too much. Rav Shlomo would say that all the time. Don't think so much. What's the first thing that comes to your mind? Right? What's the first thing? Yoni, come on.
If I knew these characters better, and the souls better, it'd be much easier.
No, the character. Okay. One of the inner senses, one of the spirit, one of the mitzvah.
Okay. I was trying to add Joseph. All right, nice. So you were saying that in one of the previous classes that the two like basic physical drives in life are two of the is food and sex. And Joseph, I saw he was conquering those with food because he had this dream where he filled the storehouses of Egypt. So he kind of defeated the famine and hunger there. And he also resisted the seduction of Potiphar. So he was conquering, I guess, the sex drive there. And I think that's related to truth. A lot of times the drives are really irrational. And you think, oh, I really want to eat this, or I really have this really strong desire. And then if you fulfill it, you know, maybe 5 seconds later, that's it. You know, I wanted it so badly. Now, I mean, it is so irrational. And it becomes like crystal clear to you the moment afterwards. Like, how is my mind so compelled in this direction?
Until the next time, right?
And it just, I guess, like, truth is just hidden. So if you can keep clear vision on what's true, and I guess, and keep your moods and passions under control, then a long foundation for living a good, like, rational and balanced life.
Good. That's very nice. Yeah. Good. Yeah, cool. Okay, who else? Come on, just jump in there. Jump. Yeah, Shalom. Go for it.
Maybe they haven't been in there in most of your classes, but go with that. Is King David and lowliness, and the sphere is kingdom, Malchut. Right, so there's a paradox there. On the one hand, talking about kingdom, and at the same time, it's talking about lowliness, and the idea is to get a sense of what is real malchut, real kingdom, is to make space, or to, so to speak, get out of the way for God's malchut to manifest, for God's kingdom to manifest, and that the more that we put ourselves on a pedestal, the less room we have for Hashem's manifestation, for the manifestation of God's kingdom. So the connection with prayer, obviously, is the recognition that it's God's, you know, that it's all about recognizing that everything is coming from Hashem and making space for that to actually happen. Not to interfere with it.
Beautiful. Well, okay, I think we have a point though, right? Now this is a beautiful example. A lot of the class is actually one that we're talking about doing right now, is the ladder of prayer from the practical to the mystical. This phrase, from the practical to the mystical, I think is very, very important, because so many people think of Kabbalah or even Hasidut as just being very intangible, very impractical. Just nice ideas, but what do I do with it? So that's why, like, for example, Rav Shlomo was a master. He would take a Hasidic piece and he would bring all of these very practical examples. He'd be giving over the Torah, but he wants to bring an example. Because if you just leave it up here, he'd always say, how do you know when you love someone? And it doesn't matter what he was talking about, but he'd find a way to relate it to. And as we're bringing this series to a close, I think this is just a beautiful way to end learning about meditation, because meditation is like the epitome of spiritual, mystical, ethereal, like way up in the clouds, and yet what we're trying to teach here is it always has to be connected to this world, the soul in the body, to mitzvot, and to the world that we live in. And so therefore, in Jewish meditation, is actually quite practical. It needs to be translated into the real world. So here we're taking all of the prayers of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which can be very, very hard to hang on to. This is where, like, we get these fleeting moments of clarity, fleeting moments of truth, fleeting moments of feeling certain things. Then how do we then build a life around that? So the using this meditation in Sukkot is a way to do it. And then once we do it in Sukkot, then we can just translate it back into the meditation of every day. How we can use this meditation in order to continually draw life force into ourselves, like when we draw the lulav in, and we can also use it as a way to then manifest this in the world. And we began the whole meditation that this is what's called the orientation of the Jew in the world. The idea of learning these six mitzvot particularly and surrounding ourselves with them at all times, it becomes our orientation. It becomes what's called our worldview. Our worldview becomes constructed from how we fit in this divine space. And so it's said about the Baal Shem Tov, and of course other tzaddikim, that he lived in this divine space at all times. But he could be carrying on a conversation with someone about the most practical things. The Baal Shem Tov is known for not just worrying about, but taking responsibility for people's physical, material livelihood. In other words, it really was important to him that everyone had what to eat and had a home over their head, because he knew in any tzemach ein Torah, if there's no flour, there's no Torah. But he could be having a conversation with you about your cow and your donkey and your milk, but he was totally in this divine space of all times. He was totally surrounded with this orientation. So at that moment he's talking to you about your cow, so he's putting a slightly more orientation on the love of God and chesed. Because as all chassidus teaches, how do you love God? By loving your fellow Jew and your fellow man. That's why it says, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, ani Hashem. Love your neighbor as yourself, I am God. So everyone asks, why does it have to say, I am God? It says, I am God all over the Torah. Why does it have to say it here? To teach us, when you love your neighbor as yourself, that's how you love God. And you want to know I am God, you want to know God? So love your neighbor. So the Baal Shem Tov is talking to someone about their chickens, but that's just a manifestation of his love of God and his chesed and his manifesting Avram in the world and his love of the fellow Jew. And if he's teaching Torah, so then he's a little bit more oriented to the oneness of God and the knowledge of God. And if he's teaching Musar to his students, or he has to rebuke someone, then the Gevura is coming through. So one last thing. Sukkot is all about joy. That's the key word of Sukkot, is joy. And we learned that the joy of Sukkot is very, very dependent on coming out of Yom Kippur feeling purified, renewed, atoned for, forgiven. That is a tremendous joy. That is a tremendous, tremendous joy. And there's two very, very beautiful teachings as to the connection of Sukkot with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That the top of the Sukkot is called the Schach. That's the greenery. And the numerical value of Schach equals 100. So one teaching is, we're talking conceptually, where does the Schach of the Sukkot come from? Comes from the 100 blasts of the shofar in Rosh Hashanah. Meaning, your Sukkot will be as good as how much energy and seriousness you took Rosh Hashanah. That the 100 blasts of the Rosh Hashanah becomes transmuted, transformed into the Sach. The other teaching about Yom Kippur is there's a machloket in the Gemara as to what exactly the Sukkah represents. One version is it represents the physical booths that we lived in when we came out of Egypt. As we traveled in the desert, that's what we had. We had poles, we had some palm branches, and when we had to stop, we put up sukkahs. That's what we built in. The other opinion is it represents the clouds of glory. Not so much the physical booths, but the fact that we were surrounded for 40 years by God's protective clouds of glory. So when you have a disagreement like that, who's right? Both. And this is a beautiful understanding where the physical booths and the spiritual clouds of glory, they're both right. They're both true. And so therefore, so then the question is, okay, where does this cloud of glory, if the Schach of the Sukkah represents the clouds above us, where does it come from? So the answer, when the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur went into the Holy of Holies, he went in with incense, which made a cloud. So where does this cloud go? It becomes the Schach of Sukkot. So what does that teach us? Again, how deep we went in to ourselves on Yom Kippur, that will be how good and joyous your Sukkot is. One of my absolutely favorite teachings of Rav Shlomo, I probably quoted this hundreds of times, and I'll gladly do it again. He said, it might be that not every Jew is holy, but every Jew is the Holy of Holies. So the more we realize that on Yom Kippur, especially about ourselves, we need to know how holy we can be. We need to know that there is a place inside of us called the Holy of Holies. That is how joyous our Sukkot will be. So I want to bless everyone to go into the Holy of Holies, this Yom Kippur. It's waiting for us to go in. And then we should take the cloud of glory in the Holy of Holies and make the most beautiful Sukkah and experience the most joyous Sukkot ever.
Amen.
Amen.
Amen.